Tomorrow morning, millions of people around the world will be gathering for Easter sunrise service. Others are going to be meeting at special locations to search for Easter eggs and chocolate bunnies. And some will even gather together for a special Easter dinner with family and friends. Now, I believe that everybody in here understands that Easter is, in fact, not a Christian holy day. But why do we believe Easter is not a Christian holy day? I think occasionally when opportunity comes up, we in the ministry are responsible to speak in season, as the Bible admonishes us. And it is the season. Often because of the days of unleavened bread, we don't get to stand up the day before Easter and say, hey, why don't we keep Easter? And I find that this kinds of basic sermons, what I'm going to say today is very basic. Many of you probably know ahead of time and can guess some of the scriptures I'm going to turn to. But I think it's faith building occasionally to go back and just review, why don't we keep Easter? And when somebody asks you, what do you say? Linda works in an office with people who are not terribly religious. There's a Jewish lady who takes the weekend shift because Linda works Monday through Friday, who works at the front desk in the office. And Linda asked her to come in, you know, and take over for her last Tuesday. And the woman is Jewish. And she was asking Linda, well, why are you taking the day off? And Linda said, well, it's the days of unleavened bread. And the lady says, now, what day is it? And what do you eat? She's a Jew by birth and by declared religion, but she obviously wasn't practicing. And then she remembered, oh, yeah, I don't know if I can take that time or not because the night before is Seder, isn't it? And I'm not exactly sure even of her own faith this time of the year. And Linda was telling me that yesterday everybody was talking about Good Friday because their office closed at noon for official operation. And a number of the ladies were asking Linda, they said, well, you're married to a minister. What's Good Friday all about? A lot of people don't even know what it's all about. And some of them don't care to know. I went down to the hardware store yesterday because I was working on a project to install a dishwasher in our apartment. And I was looking for a part. And one of the workers came over to me and said, can I help you? And I said, yes, this is what I'm looking for. And he was helping me try to find it. And I noticed there were a lot of people in the hardware store. And I said, where'd all the people come from? And he looked at me like I was from a different planet. And he said, well, it's Good Friday. He says, a lot of people are off work and everybody's doing home projects today. Oh, Good Friday. And I just happened to throw out a couple of questions while he was helping me rummage through the brass bin looking for a little connector. He said, I said, why do they call it good? And he kind of paused a little bit. You could tell he was running the memory reel. And then I said, you know, I've always had a problem with the math. And he says, the math? I said, yeah. How do they get 3 days and three nights from Friday evening to Sunday morning? And you could tell his brain was kind of chugging along. He looked at me and he looked back at the brass bin and he looked at me again and he said, that's an interesting question. About that time he found my part and I just walked away. I wonder how long throughout the day he thought about that. Probably 2 nanoseconds till he got back to his usual schedule. Let's go to Ezekiel 8. This is where I'd like to begin. Ezekiel chapter 8. As I said, you can only imagine that many millions of people will be gathering tomorrow morning to watch the sunrise in celebration of the resurrection of the Son of God. We know very clearly that these celebrations occurred many, many centuries before Christ. And in fact, they're described in the Bible. Let's go to Ezekiel 8 and verse 13. Ezekiel was a prophet that was specifically sent to the tribe of Judah. A lot of his prophecies pertain to Israel, who was already in captivity. The temple was still standing, hadn't been destroyed yet. And as we shall see, the religion of the temple, the true religion, had begun to dissipate. And God lines up a bunch of prophecies against Judah. And let's pick up the story in verse 13, Ezekiel 8, verse 13. And he said to me, "Turn again, and you will see greater abominations that they are doing." I'll leave it to you to read the ones in the previous three chapters. But he says, there's a greater abomination than all of these. So he brought me to the door of the north gate of the Lord's house. And to my dismay, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. Who's Tammuz? Well, all you have to do is Google Tammuz and you can easily find out. In other words, the information is readily available. It used to be years ago, you had to kind of dig and research and dig out the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, because in 1911, they focused on theological topics. And so that particular edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica became very famous for that. And I bought, when I got out of Ambassador College, I shopped for an 11th edition and I bought it and I moved that 200 pounds of books, several different moves during my early ministry. And then I realized, this is a pain, and I only go to that thing probably two or three times a year for research. But it used to be a lot more difficult to research the origins of some of these words, but not now. You know, yesterday morning as I was preparing this, I went to the internet and just typed in Tammuz, and I got about 20,000 responses. And you go right down the first page, and boom, 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 he's identified. Tammuz is an ancient nature deity, worshipped in Babylonia originally, a god of agriculture and flocks. He personified the creative powers of springtime. He was loved by the fertility goddess Ishtar, who, according to one legend, was so grief-stricken at his death that she contrived to enter the underworld to get him back. According to another legend, she killed him and later restored him to life. These legends and his festival, commemorating the yearly death and rebirth of vegetation, corresponded to the festivals of the Phoenician and Greek Adonis and the Phrygian Attis. The Sumerian name of Tammuz was Dumuzi, and this is from the Columbia Encyclopedia, 6th edition. So there's plenty of information describing who it was. It was the god, Tammuz, who was associated with the springtime. So when we're reading here in this historical account from what Ezekiel saw as he walked through the north door and looked at the side, he would be looking at the north side of the temple. God said, look over there. You want to see something that's worse? Look over there. And he saw women worshiping Tammuz. Inside, think about this, inside the temple courtyard. They were worshiping this pagan god. In verse 15, he said, "And then have you seen this, O son of man? Turn again, and you will see greater abominations than these." So something worse than worshiping a pagan god. So he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house. Now we go from the outer court, sometimes called the court of the Gentile, into the inner court, and at the door of the temple of the Lord, which faced east, the way the temple was laid out, the door faced to the east. So he walked around the corner of the temple, and he walked up on the porch of the temple where the door was, and to the east would have been the inner court, and then beyond the inner court, after a wall, would have been the outer court, this court of the Gentiles, and then would have been the wall of the Temple Mount. So it was kind of layered by steps, and it was also separated by walls, rock walls. most of that is gone today, and you couldn't see it unless you looked at a model of the temple. So he brought me into the inner court, verse 16, of the Lord's house, and there at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east. And they were worshiping the sun, S-U-N, toward the east. And if you look directly east from where the temple used to be, beyond these walls I've described, you will come to the Mount of Olives. And if you've ever visited Israel and visited the Temple Mount, you can face east from the temple platform and you will see the Mount of Olives. And today the Mount of Olives is covered in graves. Thousands and thousands of graves, most of them covered in some sort of crypt, concrete crypt. And of course, Christians are buried there, Jews are buried there. And the reason they're buried there is because they read the same prophecies you and I do, that Christ will return to the Mount of Olives, and they want to be there first to meet him, not understanding the nature of resurrection. Because once we're resurrected and glorified like Christ, we know from reading the examples of what he did and his appearing and disappearing after his ascension, the fastest thing in the world is what? Some people think it's the speed of light, but it's not. It's the speed of thought. Thought is 35,000 times faster than light. So if you're thinking that you want to be somewhere, you can do it. You don't have to be present. It's kind of a sidebar. I want to go there. Let's drop down to verse 17. And he said to me, "Have you seen this, O Son of Man? Is it a trivial thing to the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they commit here?" Now you can imagine how God felt angry that people were gathered in the temple yard in front of the altar and they had their backs to God, who was in the Holy of Holies, figuratively, inside the temple, and they were facing east to the rising sun. In connection with the worship of Tammuz, the sun god, who was returning in its force in the springtime to bring life to the earth, supposedly, with the regeneration of the cycle of agricultural life. "Have you seen this, O Son of Man?" he said in verse 17. "Is it a trivial thing to the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with violence. Then they have returned to provoke me to anger. Indeed, they put the branch," and the original language says, "to my nose." And I think I've explained this before. In a desert climate, instead of toilet paper, they use sticks. And that's what God is saying, that somebody has stuck the stick in my nose that they have used. That's the way God feels about this sort of practice. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 11. 1 Kings 11. Verse 4. This chapter is about Solomon. It's like a historian wrote an epitaph about Solomon and a judgment. Now we know at one point Solomon was the golden boy. He was the son selected by David to replace him as king of Israel. And his 40-year reign is sometimes called the golden years of ancient Israel. They prospered, they expanded their borders, they inherited it under his reign what was originally given to them as the promised land. And through the many marriages he had, he was able to negotiate political alliances and peace treaties with the nations around him. It says that he entered into marriages with the princes of the Hittites and the Egyptians and the Amorites and the Moabites and all those nations around them. And a lot of his marriages were arranged marriages for political reasons. A lot of people think, oh, he was a very lustful man and he married all these women. Well, I think it was more for political advantage than anything else. Because if you're married to the king's daughter, it's very unlikely he's going to wage war against you and kill his own daughter. That's the way they thought in these days. So with all these arranged marriages for political reasons, so he had all these wives and concubines. We've read about those before, and they got him into trouble. Notice verse 4, 1 Kings 11. For it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods. I've often wondered, how did that happen? To a man who was close to God and asked for God's spirit, asked for God's wisdom, and God granted it to him. How does a man like that turn from God? Well, brethren, it could happen to any of us in this room. In fact, most of us have probably known people that were deeply converted and perhaps served in the ministry, and they have drifted away. It happens. There's plenty of warning in the scripture, some of which we'll read today, where people have drifted away from their original beliefs that they held very close and near and dear and made important life-changing decisions about. And yet they drifted away. Solomon drifted away from God. From every indication, he has committed the unpardonable sin. He had God's Holy Spirit, and he drifted away. So it was when Solomon was old, verse 4, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to God, to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. And verse 5, for Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Amorites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord as did his father David. That gives us some hint as to how this drift took place. It probably began in very small ways. He married a Zidonian princess, and after a few years, perhaps, she said, you know, I really miss the festivals that we used to have. They were so much fun. We had Cadbury bunnies, and we had colored eggs, and we had ham dinner. You know, we had all these things. I really miss that. Could you just set aside a time for me to do that, to worship Tammuz? A couple more years went by. Could you erect a statue up there? So when we look east, we can see it as the sun rises over the Mount of Olives. Could you do that for me? Meanwhile, every day, Solomon's going in and out of the temple, going to the priests, involving himself in the sacrifices like the kings did. But little by little, he drifted away from God. Verse 7, then Solomon built the high place for Chemosh, the abomination of the Moabites, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem, right on the Mount of Olives, and for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all of his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. He had two personal conversations with God. Who's experienced that? Maybe Abraham. Most of us would love to sit down and have a conversation with God, wouldn't we? Get a lot of questions for him. Solomon had conversations with God. And verse 10, it had commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other gods. But he did not keep what the Lord had commanded. And we know that he eventually drifted away. It's kind of interesting. Ashtaroth is the name of the supreme goddess of Canaan. the female counterpart of Baal. The name and cult of the goddess were derived from Babylonia, where Ishtar, another derivative that is often interpreted Easter or Ashtaroth, represented the evening and the morning stars and was especially prevalent in the spring of the year. She was known as the goddess of fertility. Let's notice verse 11. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. And we know this prophecy was fulfilled at Solomon's death. There was civil war in Israel, and the 10 northern tribes split off. The southern two tribes, Benjamin and Judah, formed the nation that was called Judah hereafter. It was split, and the one who took the majority of the kingdom to the north was originally a servant in the house of Solomon. It's a sad day. He had been warned, and all of Israel had been warned. If you go back to Deuteronomy 12, verse 28. God says through Moses, Deuteronomy 12:28, observe and obey all these words which I command you, that it may go well with you and your children after you forever, when you do what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God. Now verse 29, when the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their land, take heed, God warned them, take heed to yourself that you do not be ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I also will do likewise. One of the responsibilities of a king in ancient Israel was to read the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. Not only to read them, but he was to read them and then he was to copy them. That's what a king did in preparation for his kingship. Do you suppose Solomon read these words? Do you suppose Solomon wrote them down? Absolutely. But they've been preserved for us, haven't they? For our admonition, as Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. These things happen for our admonition. What can we learn? Well, we can learn about the dangers of drift. It didn't happen overnight, did it, that the Israelites would say, well, you know, I think I'm just going to stop obeying God and I'm going to go across the street to the temple of Molech, or the temple of Ishtar, and I'm going to worship her or him. How did it happen? Well, lethargy. People got lethargic, didn't they? Obeying God. We read earlier in Ezekiel, they got so lethargic that they even worshipped these pagan gods in the temple courtyard. I mean, that amazes me. How do you get by with that? How does that happen? You have to drift a long way, don't you, for that to happen. But, you know, you and I have been around the church, many of you, for many, many years. What happened to some of those people we knew in 1995 and 96 and 97? I ran into a friend one time. I was visiting a town where we had the Feast of Tabernacles. And I hadn't seen him in years. And he drifted away from the church. And I saw him on the sidewalk, and we exchanged greetings. Hadn't seen each other in a long time. And he says, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm here keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. And he kind of looked at me and says, man, I haven't heard that expression in a long time. Feast of Tabernacles. He says, is that this time of the year? This is a man who was in the church for decades, who had given up jobs for the Sabbath and the holy days, who dedicated himself to God for many, many years. And he couldn't remember what season of the year the Feast of Tabernacles took place. It was like somebody took a scrub brush to his brain. And he says, Dave, you don't need to keep those days anymore. He says, Christmas and Easter are a lot more fun. And then he started needling me, you know, a little bit. Like some old classmates who wanted to have a reunion with us. Linda joined me to meet some of my old college buddies who at one time were in the ministry. And they needled us a little bit, pulled out cigars and lit them up, started smoking cigars in front of us and blowing smoke around, saying, oh, that's right, Dave, you can't smoke a cigar, can you? People drift, don't they? And it sometimes is absolutely amazing how far people can drift. And God specifically warned people to watch out. Make sure we don't drift. Let's go over to verse 32. Very important statement that we're going to read at least three times. Deuteronomy 12, verse 32. Whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it, nor take away from it. People love to do this, don't they? Like I said, there's information out there all over the place. All you have to do is Google Easter. Google Easter. And hundreds, probably thousands of websites will tell you it has its origins in pagan idolatry. The worship of the sun god, Sunday morning service. I mean, it's not hidden. It's very public today. Yet people want to add to it. They say, well, we kind of like the frivolity and the festiveness of this. And what we've done is we've put Christ's name on it. And it's okay now. We have Christianized. We baptized the pagan holidays and now it's okay. You shall not add to it nor take away from it. I don't think God approves just because you put Christ's name on an old practice that it makes it different. You know, as the old saying goes, if you put lipstick on a pig, it's still a pig. Right? Let's go to Acts 12, because some people will say, Acts 12 and verse 4, some people will say, well, Easter's in the Bible. And Easter is in the authorized version of the Bible. Anybody in the room, I don't mean to embarrass anybody, but anybody here have an old King James version of the Bible? Yeah, a couple people. Some people prefer that. We have used in our standard of writing, in our publications, and also most of the ministers for preaching, we have used the New King James. That's what I'm using today, the New King James version. But some people like the authorized version, you know. As my grandmother would say, if it was good enough for King James, it's good enough for me. But the translators in 1611, when it was translated from the Greek and the Hebrew, oftentimes made assumptions. And one assumption they made is found here in Acts 12. Let's read Acts 12, beginning in verse 1. Now about that time, Herod the king stretched out his hand to harass some from the church. And he killed James, the brother of John, with a sword. So this was the first martyr after Stephen, the first martyr of the apostles. And because he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to seize Peter also. And it was during the days of unleavened bread, because they were all in Jerusalem probably. Keeping the same days we are over 2,000 years ago. And so when he arrested him, in verse 4, he put him in prison and delivered him to the four squads of soldiers to keep him, intending to bring him before the people after Passover. That's what it says in the New King James, Passover. But in the authorized version, it says after Easter. Because the original word is Pasha, P Pasch, which even sounds like Passover, doesn't it? And all you have to do is go to most commentaries. Again, you can type in Acts 12:4 on Google, and you'll find commentary after commentary after commentary. It will tell you that it was wrongly translated by the translators in 1611 from Passover. And we've talked about this before, that Passover can mean not only the day, but also the 8 days from Passover until the last day of unleavened bread. Let me just share with you from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. Easter was an iconochristic mistranslation of the Greek Pascha, in which the authorized version followed such earlier versions as Tyndale and Coverdale. The Acts passage refers to the 7-day Passover festival, including the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It is reasonably certain that the New Testament contains no reference to a yearly celebration of the resurrection of Christ. It's not in the Bible. There's no command to celebrate the resurrection of Christ. There is no example of it in the New Testament church. It just didn't happen in Scripture. This is from the continue on in the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. The term Easter was derived from the Anglo-Saxon Astarte, the name of the goddess of spring. In her honor, sacrifices were offered at the time of the vernal equinox. By the 8th century, the term came to be applied to the anniversary of Christ's resurrection. So universally, it took about 800 years for it to be called Easter and dogmatically celebrated the resurrection of Christ. From the book entitled Too Long in the Sun, Richard Reeves wrote this: the English word Easter is derived from the names Ishtar, Ashtarte, or Ashtaroth. Astarte was introduced into the British Isles by the Druids and is just another name for Beltis or Ishtar of the Chaldeans and Babylonians. After much debate, the Nicene Council in 325 decreed that Easter should be celebrated on the first Sunday after the vernal equinox. The pagan festival of Easter originated as a worship of the sun goddess, the Babylonian Queen of Heaven, who was later worshipped under many names, including Ishtar, Sibyl, Ashtaroth, Mater, and Astarte, for whom the celebration of Easter is named. This pagan festival was supposedly Christianized several hundred years after Christ. So that's a direct quote from Richard Reeves. I like the title of his book, Too Long in the Sun, talking about all the sun worship that has taken place down through the ages. Let's go to Galatians 4. Galatians chapter 4 and verse 8. Galatians 4, 8. Now, I think we have to bear in mind, who is Paul writing to? Well, he's writing to the church at Galatia, which was in Asia Minor. Just to give you a little background of the period of Galatia, it was part of the Roman Empire, of course, and the Romans conquered the Greeks, and the Greeks had 13 gods. They were polytheistic, very superstitious people. In fact, Paul referred to this, the Greeks were superstitious, because they had pitted these gods one against the other, and you had to appease your god in order to conquer another god to make sure you didn't fall under an evil spell. You know, they had all these superstitions going on. Well, when the Romans conquered the Greeks, they borrowed all 13 gods, and they even added a 14th called the unknown god. They wanted to cover all their bases. So just in case they didn't cover them all, which were basically gods of nature, water, earth, sun, sky, vegetation, love, you know, on and on. They had all these gods that had their particular venue of dominance. They wanted to make sure they got all the bases covered, so they had the unknown god. And in fact, I mentioned this before, but you can go to a number of museums in the Middle East. I think the one that I saw it in was in Istanbul, the Museum of Archaeology in Istanbul. There's a pedestal. It's about 2 feet tall, and it doesn't have a statue on top of it, but it has an inscription. It says, "To the unknown God." And this refers back to what Paul talked about in Acts 17, where he appeared before the governor, basically, and said, "I'm here to represent that unknown God," because he knew they could relate to that. Oh, the God that kind of covers everything that we missed with the other 13. So they were polytheistic in their nature. So the background of the members in the church at Galatia was either they were Jews who lived in Galatia, or they were basically ex-pagans. They'd all come out of that influence of the polytheistic world. So let's read here in verse 8, this warning that Paul gives, Colossians 4, verse 8. He says, "But then indeed, when you did not know God, you served those which by nature are not gods." They're not really God. Like Paul said, you know, there's no problem with an icon. There's no problem even going into the temple of a foreign god, because they can't hurt you. You know, they're inanimate objects. They're just stone and wood. And this is the theology that all these people knew before God called them. You serve those which by nature are not really gods. They really didn't have any power. They're just superstition. Verse 9, "But now, after you have known God," or rather I should say are known by God. See, God calls first, and we respond to that call. "How is it that you turn again to the weak and beggarly elements?" He says, how is it now that you're worshiping gods that really have no power? They're weak. I don't know how many of you saw that movie, The Gladiator. Remember, The Gladiator had his little icon? And he prayed to that before he fought in a battle. Put it down. It was made out of some sort of metal, and he'd pray to it for his survival in the battle. And he'd take his little precious icon and put it in his pocket. And what Paul is saying is that doesn't really have any power. There's no strength in that. It's a weak and beggarly element to which you desire again to be in bondage. Members in the church in Galatia were going right back to idolatry. Now today in America we think, well, how could they do that? Well, people love to see something they can worship. You know, the New Testament church is commended because, according to John, he says, you worship a God you cannot see. He continues on, verse 10, he says, "You observe days and months and seasons and years." Most of the holidays that are worshipped in the culture around us that are called Christian, Christmas and Easter, are ushering along the calendar into a new season, right? Can't wait for the winter to end, so we start bonfires to attract the sun, and at the end of the year we want the sun god to return at the end of the winter solstice. And the days are the shortest. We want the sun to come back. We want the days to be longer. And in the spring of the year, when we want our plants and our gardens to grow, we want to attract the sun. We want to have the growing season bless us so that our crops grow. You observe days and months and seasons and years. Verse 11, Paul says, "I am afraid for you, lest I have labored for you in vain." You know, every minister lays awake at night worrying about people that God has called. They're part of his church, but he sees them growing lethargic and then drifting. It's painful. Very painful to experience that. And I know I can understand what Paul is writing here to these people. He's trying to encourage them to stay with what they've been taught, to continue in the faith, as we would say today. But like Christmas, you know, the trappings of Easter are very attractive, especially to children. If you've been in a store in the last 2 months, you know exactly what I'm talking about. All the advertising, the decorations, it's all targeted, isn't it? It's all targeted. Bunnies and eggs, new clothes. We used to talk about the Easter bonnet many, many years ago when the women all wore bonnets, right? Got a new bonnet for Easter. Family dinners, family gatherings, all the drinking. Be a lot of partying going on tomorrow, right? Go to church for sunrise service, and you come home, have the big Easter dinner, then you get drunk. Of course, not everybody does that, but oftentimes these celebrations turn into, well, what the ancient Israelites did when Moses went up into the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. I'd like to share another quote with you from, this is from the Encyclopedia Mithrica under the article Astara, another name for Easter or Astarte. In the ancient Anglo-Saxon myth, Ostara is the personification of the rising sun. In that capacity, she is associated with the spring and is considered to be a fertility goddess. She is the friend of all children. And to amuse them, she changed her pet bird into a rabbit. Ever heard of the rabbit in the hat? Kind of a tradition in this pattern. This rabbit brought forth brightly colored eggs, which the goddess gave to the children as gifts. From her name, the rites and festival of Easter is derived. Ostara, or Easter, is identical to the Greek Eos and the Roman Aurora. And again, I found these on the internet just typing in Easter. Information is readily available. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 4. Verse 2, we read another warning. Deuteronomy 4, 2. While God is in the process of giving his law to the ancient Israelites, he inserts this little admonition. Deuteronomy 4:2, you shall not add to the word which I command you, nor take from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you. Your eyes have seen what the Lord did at Baal Peor. For the Lord your God has destroyed from among you all the men who followed Baal. Do you think God is happy because this culture and other cultures put Christ's name on it? I don't think so either. Verse 4, but you who held fast. He's talking to those men and women who went into the promised land. He says, to you who held fast to the Lord your God, you are alive today, every one of you. And I think that's the message that we can glean from these warnings, is that we need to hold fast, don't we? To what God has revealed to us, the truth. You know, don't take that for granted. That's why it's good on occasion to rehearse some of these very basic facts that we already know about these holidays. You held fast. And that is the challenge today, isn't it? How do we hold fast to what God has given us? Let's go back to 2 Timothy. I'd like to read these words. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 13. Paul wrote to this young evangelist, and it's preserved for our admonition today. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 13. Hold fast the pattern of sound words which you have heard from me in faith and love which are in Christ Jesus. That good thing which was committed to you, that's the truth. that was committed to us, that was revealed to us. Remember years ago, you know, people said to me, Dave, you don't really need to keep the Sabbath and you don't really need to keep the holy days. And I said, you know something? God miraculously called the family that I grew up in out of the Pentecostal church. And he did not give us a round trip ticket. I can't go back to that. The good thing which was committed to you, that's the truth of God, keep by the Holy Spirit that dwells in you. Israel rejected it. Solomon turned it down and drifted away. Ancient Judah drifted away. The Jews drifted away. The members in Galatia drifted away, some of them. One of the ways that we can guarantee we will not continue to drift away is to respond to God's Spirit and to remind ourselves from time to time why we believe what we believe. Because truly we do have a good thing. We have the truth of God that has been given to all of us. Now verse 15. This you know. See, I'm not telling you, everybody here, anything new. This you know, that all those in Asia have turned away from me. There were a lot of people in Asia that Paul had worked with. He'd responded to God's call in their lives. He visited them. He encouraged them. He probably baptized hundreds of them. He ordained elders. And a lot of them drifted away. Unfortunately. They just drifted away. Let's go to Revelation chapter 20. I'd like to end up here at the end of the book. Revelation 20, verse 18. Revelation 20, verse 18. I'm sorry, Revelation 22. That's the end of the book, right? Revelation 22, verse 18. For I testify to everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book, talking about the Bible, not just the book of Revelation. If anyone adds to these things, God will add to him the plagues that are written in this book. That's pretty scary. I think the world should be a little more careful about what they add to these pagan teachings. Like I said, just because you add the name of Christ to it doesn't mean that it's the truth or that it's to be taken lightly. You know, God said, do you think it's a trivial thing? He said that to the servant, the prophet Ezekiel. Do you think it's a trivial thing to God what is done? I don't think it is. For I testify to everyone who hears the words of this prophecy of this book. If anyone adds to these things, God will add to him the plagues that are written in this book. Now verse 19. And if anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God shall take away his part from the book of life, from the holy city, and from the things which are written in this book. It's pretty clear, isn't it? Ancient Israel drifted from God and fell into idolatry. And because of that, he put them into captivity, took away their national identity. Ancient Judah drifted away from God. Solomon drifted away from God. The members in Galatia and Asia Minor, many of them drifted away from God. Many of our friends have drifted away from God. I think the question we need to answer is, how will God write about us? How will history record what we have done? That's why I think we need to determine to hang on to that good truth, that good thing that God has given us by the power of His Spirit, to hang on to that and to be reminded occasionally why we believe what we believe. And more important than how will history record our life and our end, how will God record it? What does God think? Which is the most important thing. What does God think about us and what we do with the truth that He has given us?